On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, Connor Griffin is on his way to the big leagues. In fact, he's probably already there. The Pittsburgh Pirates' top prospect, phenom, wunderkind, whatever you want to call him. Pirates actually called him up. He'll be starting at shortstop today in their home opener. We dive deep into Connor Griffin, what he is, what he could be, what he will be. We'll also, you know, freak out about the Red Sox and do a version of the good, the bad, the ugly. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world more talented than Connor Griffin. I said it. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. This kid is being such a teenager right now, by the way.
He really is, and we don't get to say that about baseball players in the major leagues that we talk about on this podcast very often. In fact, have we talked about the last time we had a teenage hitter in the big leagues? We didn't have a podcast in 2018, which is funny to think about. That was in the interim period when Jake and I were focused on blogging for Cut 4 on MLB.com and no time
doing whatever Rod Manfred told us to do.
Exactly. That was the gig. Fortunately, we have resumed potting at many different outlets long enough to see another teenage position player in the major leagues. His name is Connor Griffin, and he is our opener.
The best prospect since Mike Trout? Question mark. Is a ridiculous, preposterous, outlandish statement. And yet, it is somewhat true. That is what we're talking about here with Connor Griffin. Griffin called up by the Pittsburgh Pirates. He will play his first ever Major League Baseball game this afternoon against the Baltimore Orioles in the Pirates' home opener. Griffin is the consensus top prospect in the entire sport. He is one of the best prospects we have seen in quite some time. Some of this maybe is hyperbole, but a lot of it is not. A million things could go wrong for any player at any time. But Griffin is about as good of a bet, about as good of a bet to be a perennial all-star as we have seen in a long, long time. I am not the prospect guy. That is Jordan Schusterman's job. So, Jordan, I think the place to begin with Connor Griffin is the elevator pitch. We'll get into the background. We'll explain the story of who he is, where he came from. But what is the elevator pitch on Connor Griffin and why people should turn on their MLB TVs at 4 o'clock on a Friday to watch this guy play for the Pirates?
4:12. Don't very specific time that game is starting today. Appropriately, a nod to the Pittsburgh area code. I think you gave us the right word to start this podcast. It is talent. And that sounds obvious. It sounds stupid. It sounds reductive. But I think that is the word that we have to begin with Connor Griffin, because that is what he has been associated with since he was 13, 12. I don't know when he started becoming like, oh my God, he's the best player at every showcase. This is someone that we have to pay attention to. Well before he was draft eligible, well before he was an LSU commit, well before he was in the minor leagues, and now well before he was a major league position player as a teenager. Because what you kind of hinted at after that, saying, oh, he's a sure bet, is something. In some ways, he has become more of that, certainly since he became into pro ball.
Yeah.
But it's the talent. It's the pure, raw, physical, God-given ability that this human has possessed on a baseball field since he started playing seriously at a very young age. And that is the excitement. It is not just the confidence in his ability to make the most of it, which we can get into, and now we are about to actually see him try and prove that that talent can turn into major league production, but it is the physical abilities, the physical skills. For him to be his size at 6'4", 210, 215, whatever he's listed at, and will be immediately one of the fastest players in baseball, to have the arm that he has, to have the very quickly blossoming defensive acumen that he has, the athleticism in the infield that he now has as a shortstop at that size, the speed, the power is there for someone his size. It is all there. And that is why, from a comparison standpoint, it's a short list. And that is why you're seeing names like Fernando Tatis Jr. and Bobby Witt Jr. thrown around, because that is the blend of potential that I think we are looking at. His ability to get there, his potential pitfalls, we can talk about those too. But as far as upside goes, yeah, we have not seen anyone like this since Trout, I think. And Griffin is a shortstop. And so he also has dabbled in center field so far in pro ball, but he's proven that he can play shortstop. And that is part of why this is so exciting.
It is an odd place to start, but I would like to start with the body. And it is always weird when you evaluate prospects to just like hyper fixate on their physicality. I understand that, but it is such a relevant part of the story because what they physically are is directly tied to what they can do and what they can be. And when we talk about Connor Griffin, there really is no physical comparison in the history of the sport of baseball as far as perennial all-stars are concerned. Fernando Tatis is the name that gets thrown around,
Tatis is the answer to me. Yeah.
But Griffin is stronger and broader shouldered than Tatis. He has more obvious muscle than Tatis. It is the closest, but in my mind, the best comparison is like former NFL wide receiver Calvin Johnson. Mm. You know, like he looks like the best wide receiver in the NFL more than he looks like the best player in baseball. And I think that that is what allows you to dream on the ceiling so much, and has always allowed you to dream on the ceiling, is like his feel to hit is not elite. This is not what we talked about with Tigers top prospect Kevin McGonigal. But what Connor Griffin physically is allows the ceiling to be in this outrageous level where people that are built like this don't move like this. They don't rotate like this. They're not nimble like this. They're not agile like this. They're not as fast as this. And that is what makes Connor Griffin Connor Griffin. So let's actually rewind the clock now and talk about where this dude came from. The actual answer is Mississippi, but he played baseball well beyond the confines of Mississippi as a teenager, as a high schooler. He was one of the most famous prep players in his class, but he did not quite rise to the level of, you know, Bryce Harper, for instance. Jordan, can you kind of encapsulate what Connor Griffin's amateur tenure was like?
Yeah, because in some respects he obviously was not on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and you can say that was just a matter of timing and when he was playing amateur baseball, but he was considered the best player in his class from a very young age, and that class notably changed after his freshman year in Mississippi, where he decides to reclassify up to the 2024 class. Now, that is an important decision.
What does that actually mean? Can you explain reclassification for people who don't know?
So this has become a trend recently. This was relevant last year with the top overall pick, Eli Willits. Oftentimes, particularly for players who are maybe a little bit old for their class, decide to reclassify so that they are no longer old for their class. They are now more in line with the age of the class that they're going into. And that is important or in Eli Willits's case, you now just become ridiculously young for your class. In Connor Griffin's case, it was a little bit more of the latter. Had he stayed in the class that he was going to be 19 years old on draft day in 2025. However, because he was so much better than everybody else, particularly against the competition he was facing in Mississippi, he decided after his freshman year to reclassify, which meant that he essentially skipped 10th grade. And you can go back and listen to him talk about this decision.
And we took interviewed the course Connor load for it, though, right?
Yeah, right. So then he's just taking, you know, a whole extra load of classes. We talked to Connor about this specific decision when we interviewed him at the Combine a couple years ago, and you can find that interview on Yahoo. But he realized, and his parents realized, like, this is going to essentially be a waste of time for us. It's not just an advantage from a draft standpoint, from a professional track standpoint, but for him to stay in high school for that long against the competition, it was just not worth it, let alone if you then got to draft day at 19, teams would view you less favorably. So instead, he was 18 on draft day. It's also like
they knew this kid was not going to be an accountant, right? Like you can talk about how we treat the professionalization of youth sports is a conversation all its own. But when you are the parent to a child as precocious and as physically gifted as this, where it is clear that he is probably going to go into the field of baseball, I think it is a reasonable and rational decision to build, you know, his teenage years around that to a certain extent.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And this is also a good time to just kind of mention some of that background. His dad is a very successful Division III softball coach at Belhaven University. Side note, they got a big conference series coming up this weekend. I don't know if he's just going to dip and head to Pittsburgh and watch his son play in the majors. I imagine he will. But Kevin Griffin, the head coach of the... Yeah? You think he'll be at all three?
No. I do not think that Kevin Griffin will be at all three games. I think that he will return to lead the Belhaven University Blazers in at least some of their matchups. The other thing, Connor Griffin, by the way, his father, Kevin Griffin, his mom, Kim Griffin, both K's, both KGs. Connor's two brothers, I believe, are Cannon with a K and Caden with a K. And that is why Connor has a K. It is because both of his parents are KG.
Yes. And so Kevin, I mentioned that because Kevin Griffin is a successful college softball coach. I'm not familiar with Kevin Griffin's background as a player. I think he might have played small college. I don't think he ever played pro ball baseball. But this is not Bobby Witt Jr., Fernando Tatis Jr. This is not the son of a major league. He did not necessarily grow up around major league clubhouses.
But it is also not Jake Mincer, Jordan Schusterman, where, our parents, our dads were not exactly thoroughly educated in the art of a swing. And so it falls into this very unique, interesting middle ground of like what your parents are able to give you if you're going to be a baseball player.
It's a great point because he was growing up on fields, around fields, but just, not the glamorous big league lifestyle. So, but the other thing I just wanted to make sure I hammer home here, because when we give this lavish introduction about him as a prospect, this might bring up the obvious question of, well, then why did he go ninth? Right? If this guy was the best prospect, best every year as a high schooler, what was going on that this guy went ninth overall? And this is a really important part of the story because this is now we get into what were the concerns, what I guess still are the concerns to a degree, particularly from just a risk tolerance standpoint. Now, part of this was not just anything Connor Griffin was necessarily doing wrong. However, on that note, it was he's a high school position player in Mississippi, beating up on competition, which has improved in recent years. Like there was a long time that Mississippi High School was considered like a really low level. I think it's a little bit better now. They've produced a lot more pro prospects. Griffin now, first and foremost. But the numbers he was putting up were so comical that you couldn't really put much stock into them. I mean, the dude stole like 80 bases in 30 games or whatever as his senior year. This is stupid stuff. He's hit the 600, 1700 OPS, whatever, all these things. And on top of the fact that on the showcase circuit, his contact skills were inconsistent. He had a swing that was powerful and occasionally productive, but it was something that you thought that, okay, the skills are here, the physical tools are here. This is going to take some time. Combine that with an incredibly productive, accomplished, talented college class in 2024, which has already produced multiple major leaguers and more to come. By default, the risk tolerance of the industry looked at Connor Griffin and said, well, he sure sounds fun, but we have these really eight college players. Braden Montgomery ends up going after him because he had this injury. But if you look at every draft ranking, there was nobody that had Connor Griffin in the top five among the public boards. Okay, nobody wanted to take that jump. Everyone had him in the 7 to 10 range. So even though we all acknowledge he's the best high school player, he has this incredible skill set, the ceiling is undeniable, the risk here and how long it's going to take, this all sounds very funny because he's about to debut as a teenager, this is going to take some time. Right. And so that is why
it doesn't.
He falls to Pittsburgh.
And then it doesn't take
at
some time.
Nine. And then we go to last year and he makes his swing change almost even before he even starts his pro career after the draft. And now you see what happens when someone with this amount of pure ability has the makeup and the aptitude to make the adjustments and give you, which I'll kick it to you here, the season that he just had as a minor leaguer last year that set the stage for this historic debut.
I would like to raise my hand and by proxy raise your hand and admit we were wrong about Connor Griffin, the player. You and I don't even know if we said this online or we wrote it anywhere. We were really low on him as a prospect coming out of high school, relatively. Like, we still thought he was like a good first round player who was worth taking. But when the Pirates took him, you and I were like, well, they're never going to figure that out.
That's the specific thing, though. That's relevant. The landing spot added to our pessimism. And I don't feel bad about that at all. Like, sorry, Pirates. No. What have you earned that we're going to be like, oh, that's where he's going to thrive? Now we've started to do that with pitchers. But to me, it was as much about the landing spot as him as a prospect. But it is true. And as I just mentioned, we are not alone in maybe underselling how quickly he was able to make these adjustments.
Right. And I think maybe what we underrated and what the industry underrated was the aptitude, was the physical intelligence that this kid had. And even if you don't trust the Pirates hitting development to make this change, that's not the whole thing, because he was going to this facility in Atlanta. Maven is the name of the facility that has helped many, many players get a whole lot better. And they deserve a lot of credit here. And then Griffin deserves a whole lot of credit here, like for being open to a change and for having the ability to implement it. And I do just think it is, you know, you got to own your misses, man. And I think that if you and I were drafting at nine, if we were running the Pittsburgh Pirates, I'm not sure that we would have taken Connor Griffin with that pick. And maybe that is why we're not drafting for a big league baseball team.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think on draft day, that was around the point, because those top seven or so college players knew were going to go in some order.
Let's just say those names. I mean, Travis Bazzano is one of the top prospects in baseball. He goes one. Chase Burns has looked incredible in his first start. Mm-hmm. Charlie Condon goes three overall to the Rockies. We thought he was not good at the time. I still think he's meh, but he has looked a whole lot better over the last couple of months. Nick Kurtz won Rookie of the Year. He goes four to the A's. Hagen Smith, talented arm in the minor leagues with the White Sox. That's the first one that makes you go, Jack Caglione, as much ceiling as Connor Griffin in some ways. J.J. Weatherholt goes seven to the Cardinals. We've already seen him be really productive in the big leagues this year. And then the one where you shrug your shoulders and you go, believe it or not, was the Angels taking Christian Moore, eighth overall, second baseman of the University of Tennessee, a pick that I liked at the time. I really like Christian Moore. And again, not a good drafted, developed guy, Jake Mitz.
But that's actually the last draft point that I want to make there, because that was also the Angels, as we've seen, are just taking college players and zooming them to the majors as quickly as possible. And so they were not in the position to be patient. Again, funny, because Connor Griffin is about to debut for someone like Connor Griffin. Whereas the Pirates, so much of just how the baseball ecosystem operates, for better or for worse, you kind of got to shoot the moon here, right? You don't have access to players with Connor Griffin's potential when you're the Pirates, because you're the Pirates and you don't have money / don't want to spend money. And so this is your chance for a super duper star. And my goodness, have they potentially found one in Griffin. And as we mentioned, that becomes very clear immediately, not just after the draft, but what he does last year, you know, as a 19-year-old in the minors, starts the year at 18, right? He's going to turn 20 here in a couple of weeks. And last year, he hits 333, 415, 527, and reaches, I guess he reaches double A.
Double A.
Yeah, 65 steals, 21 homers. And the strikeouts were, he would have some swing and miss there. He'd have some three-week stretches where he was whiffing a lot. But he just got better and better as he went. He was making adjustments so ridiculously quickly. His defense at shortstop was getting better and better. And by the end of the year, it was like, yep, this is the guy. He's ready. And that's why he came into camp with a real chance to make the team. I don't think we need to get too bogged down in why he did and didn't make the team. But it was clear with the options in front of him that it wasn't going to take very long for him to be up in Pittsburgh. And that is why now we get to talk about him as a teenage major leaguer.
Watching the defensive highlights are, like, for me, that was the most revealing moment in terms of, like, preparing to understand Connor Griffin this spring and watching clips of him from last summer playing in the minors. The defense is so impressive because we kind of just assumed the Pirates would move him to the outfield to allow him to focus on hitting. Learning how to play shortstop at the big league level is a, you know, journey, a challenge all its own. And with a player as presumably raw as this, I guess we all figured just put him in center and, you know, let him focus on learning how to hit. They leave him at shortstop, and boy oh boy, is it something else. The comp at shortstop for me is Correa. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about a player built like this that moves like this with the arm like this, there are a couple plays where Connor Griffin makes the baseball field feel small. When I was in college, I remember we had a JV game somewhere, and the varsity guys traveled too for some reason. And in between the doubleheader for the JV game, a bunch of the varsity guys went onto the Little League field next to where we were playing. And the best pitcher on our team faced off against the best hitter on our team at the Little League field, and they made me catch it because I was a freshman, right? And, you know, the kid's throwing 88 from 46 feet, and they just felt too large for the field. Like, it was like a me or you going in, the McDonald's play place. It's like, what is this person doing here? That is what Connor Griffin feels like when he's playing defense, where he's so big and he's so long and he covers so much ground that it feels like the field should be 94. The baseline should be 94 feet for him. And not 90. It is somewhat akin in my mind to Giannis, where you see Giannis take seven steps down the court and you're like, this is the wrong size game for this person. And so Connor Griffin does give off a little bit of that energy just with the way he's able to move it short.
Yeah. And he's not, again, he's big. He's not, it's funny you mentioned that because they had O'Neill Cruz playing shortstop not that long ago, who's of course the biggest shortstop we've ever seen. So he's not that big, but I agree that his physical abilities, his speed, his arm, it is Correa-esque. And I think that's a good transition to just what are reasonable expectations right away from a production and what this is going to look like. We mentioned these lofty comps like Fernando Tatis Jr. and Bobby Witt and Correa and, the potential is there for all of those things to, in tandem. I think from a production standpoint, I do think that Bobby Witt's rookie year is kind of what I'm looking at. And to remind people of what that was. Now, it's also important to remember Bobby Witt was 22 when he debuted. That was a little bit before his 22nd birthday. And we're getting Connor Griffin before his 20th birthday. Bobby Witt was old for his class. He was 19 on draft day, and he did spend some time in the minor leagues. And Bobby Witt was amazing and is amazing, So it's not like he took forever, but it still, this show shows you the difference. And yet, I'm looking at Bobby Witt's line as a freshman. There you go. See, in college baseball mode.
Freshman in Major League Baseball.
Blame Tony Vitello. And he hit as a rookie 254, 294, 428, 20 homers, 30 steals, 102 OPS plus, fourth place rookie of the year. I think some people are going to be disappointed if that's what Connor Griffin does, but if he does that as a 20-year-old,
fine.
That's fine, unbelievable. Dude. And as we just saw, what does Bobby Witt do the next year? Finishes seventh in MVP. What does he do after that? Now he's one of the three best players in the world. So how long is this going to take? I think I mentioned Bobby Witt too, because I think we also expected Bobby Witt to strike out more immediately than he did.
Yeah.
And he did have a 21% strikeout rate as a rookie. That's only gone down since then. Connor Griffin, I think it's going to be higher than league average. I just do. But I'm not putting anything past this guy in terms of just figuring stuff out on the fly. And so I think from like an on base and like the power and speed is probably going to be there right away. But that is where I'm kind of at. And honestly, why I think him as a rookie of the year bet, even though he's certainly going to have the time, is maybe not the first guy I would pick over a Weatherholt or over some of these other guys.
Picking Nolan McLean. I don't know if you know that, but I'm a big fan of him.
That's fine. This is a great rookie class. But yeah, that's where I'm at in terms of my personal expectations, which are ridiculously high, but also maybe less than I think people are at right now. I don't know.
And I think Bobby Witt is a good comparison in regards to like what this person means for this franchise too, where he is the face of it, even with Paul Skeens. Like, it's just different if you're a position player. I know Skeens is on a different level, but like if Connor Griffin becomes what we expect him to be, he will be the Pittsburgh Pirate. Like, that's just how this is going to go. And that's related to the extension conversations. You know, we had Buster Olney at ESPN saying that they're working on an extension, 9 years, $140 million. I find it odd and telling that Buster Olney tweeted this and no one else who does scoopage verified this, including Jeff Passan, who works at ESPN with Buster. That is not a coincidence. That means either this is not done or it is in the works, whatever. It certainly seems like an extension is going to get worked out between Griffin and the Pirates. He is not a Boris client. He is represented by Excel, so I think that makes it a little bit more likely that he does sign an extension when it's all said and done. And that's a big deal for Pittsburgh to keep this guy around, and it is a shot worth taking. I am, more than anything else, like, I'm excited for Pirates fans. They have not had a position player like this since Andrew McCutchen showed up. Maybe since Barry Bonds showed up. There's a legitimate argument for that. And you have this great little nugget here on our doc that since 2009, which was Jack Wilson's final season, the Pirates are last in shortstop production by an embarrassing, embarrassing margin.
I mean, I like had this thought and I was like, okay, how extreme is this? Because Jack Wilson, by the way, good player, made an all-star team. Elite defender, which was really propping up his war totals even when he was not hitting that much. That's 16 years ago that he is gone, goes to the Mariners, right? Since then, because this is one of the most underrated tools on Fangraphs, is that you can sort by position war for team and stuff. The Pirates, since 2010, have gotten 15 F war. So that's less than one per season from their players playing shortstop.
You get so much F war, by the way, by just standing at shortstop. Just like being a shortstop.
So think about that. So 15.5 F war since 2010 by Pirates shortstops. 77 combined WRC plus, which is also 30th.
Dodgers at the top of this list with 68.
Dodgers at the top of the list, 68, Rockies, you got Story and Tula, whatever. It's what's at the bottom. The Tigers are 29th at 28. So the second lowest amount of shortstop production over this time is nearly double what the Pirates have gotten from the most important position, or arguably the most important position on the field. Okay, so if there was ever a team that desperately needed a, let alone competent shortstop, a star shortstop, it is this one. And zoom farther out. Think of all, this is like the most hyper-specific example of the Pirates' misery over the last decade. But come on, it's the team with the longest postseason drought in the National League. It is a team that has a fan base that is so desperate, just wants so badly to have a reason to show up. And Paul Skeens has done that in part on his start days. But as you mentioned, it is a completely different beast for a position player that you know is going to be in the lineup, at the top of the lineup, making plays on defense, stealing bases, hitting homers. And that's why he's so important and why you would try and give him an extension as long as you possibly can. When, listen, I hope Paul Skeens, I'm not expecting an extension with Paul Skeens, but I hope he at least plays out his years in Pittsburgh as long as he can, whether until he hits free agency. For Connor Griffin, this is something that you really can get attached to in a very real way. And that's just so exciting for one of my favorite fan bases in baseball, for sure.
Buy the jersey is what I'd say. Yep.
Let's take a break. Right? Number six.
Number six. Last worn by Bailey Falter. So tough bounce for Bailey Falter. Let's take a break. And when we get back, we will gripe about the Boston Red Sox. Welcome back to Baseball Barbiecast. It is April 3rd. Good reminder for me that I need to pay my rent. But it is never too early to panic. And we need to talk about the team in the most dire early straits, the Boston Red Sox. Media mogul and former boss of the Baseball Barbiecast podcast, Bill Simmons is many things. He is one of the most important people in the history of sports media, undeniably. He is a scholar of the sport of basketball. He watches some movies. But Bill Simmons is a man perpetually with his finger on the pulse of baseball. That is obviously a fact. And earlier this week, Bill Simmons tweeted, "It's not even April, and the Red Sox season is in shambles." Fact, not fiction.
That tweet came on March 31st.
At 10:01 p.m.
One day later, not even 24 hours later, he sent a follow-up tweet, all caps, Red Sox panic tweet. That came after the Red Sox, I believe, got swept by the Astros of Houston. And while it is silly to panic at the beginning of April, or March for that matter, at the end of March, this is the team that is objectively in the worst position of any team in the sport right now. They are already four games back of first place, the largest deficit that any team faces through 1 week, thanks in part to the Yankees' strong start. They have lost five in a row since winning on opening day. As I just mentioned, they were swept in Houston by an Astros team that we are not entirely convinced is that good. However, they do still have some good baseball players, and those baseball players certainly showed up, so credit to the Astros. But it's not just that the Red Sox have lost these games. It's just this, we're already in the place where it's, oh boy, this doesn't look great. You got the... It's like the perfect mix of things, right? You've got a couple defensive blunders. You've gotten an ejection, and we already talked about that. I know that's C.B. Buckner's fault, whatever. You've got your new acquisitions are not playing well. That's Caleb Durbin is the only qualified hitless hitter, our pal Caleb. Don't love that for him. You've got Ranger Suarez and Sonny Gray and Johan Oviedo. None of those guys who are supposed to help form this terrific rotation that is the strength of the team. None of those guys pitched well in their debuts. I think in terms of concern for those guys, Oviedo, though he is not the one they're counting on the most, is at the top because his stuff looks terrible. And he's like, I don't know why. Whereas Ranger Suarez, we know this is kind of what he does. He pitches in the WBC, whatever. We have Carlos Narvaez, who is considered, like, from a makeup standpoint and just good, a clubhouse presence, as good as it gets. He got benched for a reason that has still not been made exactly clear. Did he sleep through his alarm like Carter Jensen? We'll talk about that later. So, and then Trevor Story has just been atrocious at the top of the lineup. So Roman Anthony had to sit for a day because he punched out four times in a game. As far as a five-game losing streaks goes, they're packing in a lot of things that are pissing off their own fans, right? That is maybe the best way to put it.
And you're speedrunning it. If you said to the Red Sox, okay, yes, you're going to win on opening day, and then over the next five games, we need you to make people as concerned as possible without a debilitating injury. Can you do that for us?
Well said.
And the Red Sox yeah, we got this.
So yeah, that's just kind of where we're at. Willie Abreu is doing his job. He looks
incredible.
Terrific. So he's carrying over the WBC momentum in every sense. He looks great.
Yeah.
But other than the reason I'll throw it back to you. The reason why this is silly is because it's April 3rd. The reason why it is not silly is because this is just not the division where you can really let this get away from you this quickly. And that is why their playoff odds have already dropped from 60 to 40% in a week on Fangraphs. 40% is still quite high. I still think this team is going to be good. I picked them to win the division. But you just can't afford these bad stretches in this division. And that I do genuinely believe whenever they happen in the calendar.
I'd like to toss it back to what Bill Simmons said. The first half of his tweet is the whole thing. It's not even April. It is April now. The calendar has indeed flipped over, but it is April. My cousin was staying with me last night for Passover. He is a Mets fan, and he was incredibly pessimistic. And I just had to say to him five times, dude, it's April. It's April 3rd. The season is long and full of bumps and terrors. And the team that is existing now is not going to do this for 6 months. It just will not when there's this much talent. I am not that concerned about the Red Sox, but at the same time, given the way that this team has operated in previous seasons, I think it is reasonable for fans to be frustrated. Where what fans wanted, and this is true kind of with the Mets too, but mostly with the Red Sox, what fans want is this unimpeachable, inevitable juggernaut of a team that they feel like they deserve based upon the resources and some of the talent that exists. And what the Red Sox have been made into and what the fans have been given is a lot of cheeky players, a lot of savvy moves, a lot of under-the-radar types that you're banking on this guy getting a lot better or this guy bouncing back. And maybe that does work and the Red Sox become really good. But if the Red Sox were built like the Yankees, where they had, you know, six superstars in the lineup and one of the best rotations in the sport, and they started 1-5, would Yankees fans be panicking? Yeah, duh, of course they would. Like, I'm not. Duh. However, the talent on the roster, there's a gap between these two teams, right? Like, how good we feel about them, and we're seeing that borne out right away out of the game.
Yeah. That said, we should not go any further because, like we said, it's April. However, they do now head home for their first homestand of the season, where they will face the Padres and the Brewers. The Padres, the only National League team yet without a series win, after the Rockies getting that series tub over the Blue Jays. That was weird. So the Padres have had a tough start, but they do have some good baseball players, so we will see how they do. And then the Brewers, who are definitely good, they come to town after that. So we will see if Boston can get back in the mix here, but can't fall too far behind in the American League East. We're going to take a break. When we return, the good, the bad, the ugly on this Friday.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. It is Friday, so it is time for the reason we do this show. The good, the bad, and the ugly. Jordan, what's good?
Shea Langeliers is absolutely mashing. This dude's got five homers, which is pretty impressive. Considering we played 1 week of baseball. He homered in Toronto a few times. He homered a couple times in Atlanta, the team that traded him away for Matt Olson. And what's so interesting about this start for Shea Langeliers is that he is the only one hitting on the A's. He has five of their six home runs, eight of their 17 RBIs. And the A's have otherwise been the worst offense in baseball, which is a tough look for a offense that was much hyped coming into the season. But instead of just laughing at the rest of the lineup, I do want to give Shea Langeliers some love here because he was awesome last season. He hit 31 homers. He got better on defense. He races on base percentage over 300 for the first time, 131 OPS+. And I think coming into this season, when we talked about the A's lineup, so much of the focus was on this younger wave, the Kurtz and Wilson and now Soderstrom and Butler and, you know, Rooker is, you know, a little bit more of a proven commodity, but so much about it was like, well, those young guys are obviously just going to keep getting better and they'll just all be, it's like Shea Langeliers has slowly been getting better for 3 or 4 years in a row. And now is one of the best catchers in baseball. And I don't think people give him that kind of credit. And I like that he's been able to have this start and sit atop the home run leaderboard, at least momentarily, and get some love here on this podcast. Cause I think he's awesome and is a big part of this team and probably deserved more. And especially amidst the awful start for the rest of his teammates. Good for him.
We care about pronunciation here. And I think I've been doing this one wrong. I have the MLB pronunciation guide in front of me. I've been saying Langeliers, and it is Langeliers. The emphasis is on the first syllable. So for those of you saying this name out loud, moving forward, Shea Langeliers. And that is a fact. My good this week, Tampa Bay. The Tampa Bay Rays, a number of years ago, changed not their name, but the essence of it. Going from the Devil Ray to the Sun Ray. However, they kept the animals in the trop. For a long time, the Tampa Bay Rays have had actual stingrays in a tank in center field at Tropicana Field. Now, when the Hurricane Milton happened in October of 2024, the Rays, after losing the roof to their stadium, spent the year at Steinbrenner Field. Across the way. But the Rays are back in the trop. And what that means is so too are the Rays. The seven cow-nose stingrays that weathered Hurricane Milton are back at Tropicana Field. This is good. This is wonderful. Shouts out to the Florida Aquarium for getting this done, putting the Rays back. These are the actual Rays that survived the hurricane. You know, there were not people in the building when the hurricane happened, but the Rays were in there, literally. And so it is cool that these are the Rays that are going back into the tank at the trop. I hope that whenever they build the new stadium, they still have this set up. Florida, if you've spent any time in Florida, you know they love their aquariums. They love the wet wildlife. And it is very cool that you can go to this baseball game and touch the Rays.
I do believe, and this is no surprise because of the circumstances, that the Rays are the last team to have their home opener. Every other team, I'm pretty sure, is having them this weekend. Theirs is not until Monday against the Cubs. So that will be the debut, or I guess the return, for those wonderful sea creatures that you just referenced. So shouts out to the Trop, which I have still not been to, one of the few Major League parks that I've not been to. I hope that can change at some point in the near future before they build the fancy new stadium in actual Tampa. All right, let's go to bad. My bad this week is very simple. It's an injury that is about as big of a bummer as you can get considering the circumstances, and that is Cody Ponce, who in his first start as a Toronto Blue Jay suffered an ACL injury that hopefully is not season ending. I don't know if we know that for sure, but they said he's going to miss significant time. But this is one of our favorite guys in baseball. He, of course, has been gone from the big leagues pitching in Asia for the last four seasons to get this contract with the Blue Jays, a team that, you know, to be and to immediately be relied upon is a very important part of a team trying to get back to the World Series. A lot of reason for excitement for him to have this, you know, just a fluke injury trying to play defense. It just sucks. And I know he's someone that has, him talking about coming back, is someone that clearly has a lot of good perspective on life and his journey. And I'm sure that will remain true even with this setback. But I mean, these are the kinds of injuries when you just think about what it took to get back here, that it just sucks. So, yep, pretty straightforward bad for me.
My bad is a ridiculous take given by a ridiculous character.
Yep.
We try and keep things kind on this show. Generally, we are not embracers of the beef. However, what Jim Bowden of Val Territory in The Athletic said the other day regarding Tony Vitello was downright preposterous. Jim Bowden on his show, maybe it's called Front Office Unfiltered. Finally, something unfiltered, an unfiltered podcast. I've been waiting for years. He said that Tony Vitello should be, after each game, sitting down with former Giants managers Bruce Bochy and Dusty Baker to go over the decisions, the conversations with the media. Quote, we want him to be himself, but we also don't want him to embarrass us, which he's doing right now, in my opinion. You know whose opinion I don't care about, Jordan? Jim Bowden's
opinion. I think I do. So. I think I do, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, man. It's just like, if you haven't been the... Look, we've never worked for a baseball team, so maybe we know less than this guy who worked for the Washington Nationals in 2009 and was, you know, resigned after being included in a FBI investigation. But it's just like, this take is just so silly and so stupid and like represents the, you know, the hot takery of this industry in just like a way that makes me sad.
To me, I mean, I don't disagree with anything you said. It is such an awful idea. And honestly, such a preposterous ask of Dusty Baker, and not to mention like how belittling and demeaning and disrespectful it is to Tony Vitello. Like, let's just move that to the side. Let's say that Tony Vitello, well, that's its own thing.
Let's say he needs this. Also true. Let's say Tony Vitello is like, yes, please, I would like a meeting with these two guys right. Every day.
Even if that was true. What an absurd thing. Those guys are done. They retired.
They did it, dude.
They don't want to manage. I know Dusty Baker was just managing Nicaragua. They don't want to do this anymore, and that's fine. They don't want to be at the ballpark. Also, they've already, both of them publicly, have been like, I like Tony. I support Tony. I'm here whenever Tony needs something. That's plenty. That's great. It's good that he has that available to him. To bring them in to babysit this guy. This is the most absurd idea I've ever heard. I can't believe it's coming from someone that's ever worked in a front office.
Dude. And there was one part of it was like, oh, chalk talking the media sessions. Like, they're just like sitting in his office with a clicker as they watch him talk to like Susan Slusser. Like, this is not how the job works.
That's the part.
Let's grow up.
It's an unbelievable. I can't believe this idea came from someone that ever worked in baseball. If I saw this take from some anonymous account online, I'd be like, that is so funny. It's such a bad idea. But it's like someone that doesn't understand how any of this works and why anyone would ever agree to do this. But that's not who this came from. Okay, let's go to Ugla. My Ugla could also qualify as good, but my goodness, did it make me laugh. Essentially, Munetaka Murakami is off to a very good start to his major league career. However, the White Sox are terrible. What that has led to is, this is very common where when teams get Japanese players, Dodgers are their own thing, but they come with them come a new just a wave of Japanese fans that like essentially are attached to this player and want to cheer them on and maybe want to now cheer for their major league team. Because the White Sox have been so bad, we have seen a lot online of White Sox fans being like, oh gosh, Japanese fans tuning in to watch Munetaka Murakami, I'm so sorry that our team sucks. However, the beautiful thing about this is that the Tokyo Yakult Swallows that Munetaka Murakami played for NPB are essentially a version of the White Sox. And so because they also suck, we are just seeing tweets from Swallows fans that are basically telling the White Sox fans, guys, it's fine. This is what we do. We cheer for Murakami. He hits home runs. We're happy. And then the team loses and we move on.
We lose by six.
It's like, it's great.
Right? Now, if Okamoto.
It's so good.
If Okamoto had gone to the White Sox, Okamoto, who was the face of the Tokyo Giants, who were the best team. They're like the Yankees. If Okamoto had gone to the White Sox and all of Yomiuri fans had to watch the White Sox all the time, I'm sure this would be a different dynamic. But because the Swallows are the White Sox, everything's copacetic.
It's so great. This is also good, but there's definitely an Ugla element to it. But anyway, finish us off with your Ugla.
Royals catcher Carter Jensen slept through his alarm. This was very ugly yesterday. Jensen, a rookie for the Royals, was supposed to be behind the dish on Thursday for the matinee affair between the Royals and the Twins, but he was not responding to texts. He did not show up to the yard, very understandably, leading to some concern around Royals world where they couldn't get in touch with him. They went to his parents. It was a hashtag scary moment for a little bit, but it turned out that he just slept through his alarm that put Salvian back there. And so the entire post game, the Royals, I believe, lost. And so this was not as funny as it really could have been. If the Royals had won yesterday, this would have, I think, had a goofier air. But Vinny Pasquantino put Carter Jensen on blast. I'm kidding. Vinny was like, look, he slept through his alarm. It's unacceptable. He knows that. He'll wear it and we'll move forward. Carter Jensen said, this is from Sam McDowell, from the Kansas City Star. He said, quote, I didn't wake up to my alarm, slept through it. Don't really have an excuse, nor should I. It sucks. It happens. I feel like I let my teammates down, coaches down. Just learn from it. Just let it know it won't happen again. But what makes it ugly, what makes this so good, is a tweet from at Bobby Witt Lover. Okay. This is a video that the Royals did during spring training. You see this all the time where the players like walk out and there's a prompt and they answer the prompt, right? They're carrying their bags and their gloves and they're headed out to the field and they're all having a good time. The question on this day was, how many alarms do you set to wake up in the morning? And, you know, Michael Wacha says one alarm. Vinny Pasquantino says he, you know, wakes up before his alarm. Bobby Witt says his dog wakes him up. And the last person to walk out and answer this question is Carter Jensen. And Carter Jensen says, this is embarrassing, but I need at least like 6 to 8 alarms. It's not good. Beautiful.
And beautiful. And here's the thing. Here's the thing. This is why it's so funny. He's literally the punchline in this video. Like, it's edited.
He's last.
It builds up so that at the end of the video, Carter Jensen tells you that he needs 8 alarms, right? Everybody else is saying 1 or 2. He's not just mixed in there and other guys are saying, oh, I need 5 alarms. Or it's like, no, the point of this video, when they got all this footage in spring training, and I love Royals social and PR, they do a great job. But this is, yeah, the point of this, which again, felt pretty innocuous at the time, was to make Carter Jensen look a little silly. And instead,
nailed it.
And by the way, let's pivot back to bad. Did you see what happened to him in the game yesterday?
No.
So he doesn't start at catcher as he was supposed to. But late in the game, Salvi gets pinch run for. Carter Jensen comes in to catch the 9th. They allow 3 homers in that inning. So if you thought his day wasn't bad enough, he also had to wear. That's not the reason they lost the game. They were already losing. But yeah, it was the tough look for Carter Jensen. He'll be fine. It's not a big deal.
This happens. But I've slept through my alarm for this show. Jordan has slept through his alarm before in life. This is a thing that happens. But what is funny about it is that I would not say it is a character trait of either of ours. I don't like, I'm someone that not has anymore. Slept through his alarm. I do not often sleep through my alarm. Carter Jensen told on himself and seems like someone who often sleeps through his alarms. Now, Carter Jensen, this is not an ad, but I do have a Whoop and I love my Whoop, and my Whoop buzzes. It buzzes in the morning and I cannot turn it off. It gets me out of bed. There are other ways to get out of bed in the morning, Carter Jensen, and you should explore them. You have lost the benefit of the doubt. The Royals should just hire someone who just sleeps in the living room. Just bangs on Carter Jensen's door.
That's a good use of resources, good gig. All right, that's it. We have to go because the Washington Nationals and Los Angeles Dodgers are playing a baseball game in a few hours, the Nats home opener. Dodgers, pretty good baseball team. Should probably check them out. Many other teams having their home openers this weekend. We are not going to go through that whole slate, but Obviously, that is an exciting part of any season when fans get to welcome their teams home. We will certainly be excited to watch Connor Griffin on MLB TV later on, but we will be at the Dodgers and Nationals games this weekend. But oh, so more importantly, Jake Mintz, on Saturday night, we will be at the Sabres and Capitals game where our beloved Buffalo Sabres, who we have been cheering on for our entire last year,
have a chance to
end their playoff drought with us in attendance, which is just preposterous in so many ways. And I'm so excited to be there.
Winning their end.
But with all that said, thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing this Friday edition of Baseball Barbercast. You can email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. And we will be back on Monday. Everyone have a good weekend. We'll talk to you soon.